Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Born to Talk Radio Show. I'm your host, Marcia Witeka. This is a very exciting day for me as I begin a new opportunity with Blog Talk Radio. Thanks to my friends, Sharifa Hardy and Ferran Dozier, for introducing me to the wide world of Blog Talk Radio. If you are listening for the first time, let me quickly tell you about my weekly show. The format is simple. When you have conversations plus connections, that equals community. Then add what's your story, and you've got the gist of my show. Everyone has a story. And how apropos, because today's show is all about stories. I'd like to introduce today's guest to you right now. Jim Mueller is the creator and producer of the South Bay Story Show. Welcome, Jim.
Hello, Marcia. I'm glad, so happy to be here.
I'm so happy to have you join me on my fourth show, Jim. This is outstanding. I would also like to welcome Tony Teresi. He is the award-winning stage director of the South Bay Story Show. Welcome, Tony.
Thank you. And again, I feel very privileged to be on. I appreciate it. It's going to be fun.
It certainly is. And last but not least is Wanda Maureen Miller. She is an author, and she is one of the storytellers performing on March the 24th and 25th at the South Bay Stories Show at the Second Story Theater in Hermosa Beach, California. Welcome, Wanda.
Hey, Marcia. Thanks for including me. And for short, you can call me Mo.
I'll do that from this point forward. So I thought it would be important for our listeners to know a little bit about who all three of you are. And I thought, Jim, I would start with you. Could you please tell our audience a little bit about yourself?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Like most people in Los Angeles, I came from somewhere else. I started life in Albuquerque and then moved to Rochester, New York, and lived there for about 30 years. And then came to Redondo Beach to live with my beautiful and beloved wife, Patricia. And so while I was here, it occurred to me that there were not many ways to entertain yourself here in the South Bay as far as live theater is concerned. And I really fell in love with storytelling. And that's how I came to start the South Bay Story Show way back in 2015. This will be the fourth South Bay Story Show. And I have
terrific.
One other little, just a little anecdote to tell you, and that is
sure.
I'm a computer guy by profession. That's what I did. And I just had a tremendous experience that will make a great story, and I intend to make a story out of it, because we just finished our website, which is southbaystoryshow.com, and I did it via a web designer in Pakistan. We communicated via the internet. I sent him all the images and things I wanted and my specs through the website called Fiverr, Fiverr.com. And Shogun, which is his name, built it for me in 2 or 3 days. And so it's up right now, and I hope people will take a look at it.
Terrific. That's exciting, Jim. Tony, you're up next. I'd like you to share
okay.
a little bit about your background and where you grew up and what brought you to L.A.
What brought me to L.A.? Well, I'm originally from Boston, a small New England town, and like most people that want to feel, they feel closed in, I moved away because it was just too small a town for me. So I went to New York. And there I started taking acting classes, And I was very fortunate to start studying with Lee Strasberg, that is famous for the method term of acting. And there is where I, again, started getting my roots for acting. So I did start out as an actor. And a cute story was I got an agent, and I was going out a lot for parts, and I wasn't getting them. And finally I said to my agent, I said, you know, I went out for this Western thing. And he says, well, he says, I got the call back, and they said, every time you said Haas, you said Haas and Bond. And I realized I still had my New England accent. And that's why I wasn't getting any parts, because I would be saying, you know, I want to go to the Bond, and I got to get on my Haas. And they would say, thank you, next, please. So when I realized
you
that...
You weren't getting any parts?
And I wasn't getting many parts, right. So and so in New York, that's when I started taking Shakespeare and started learning to get in control of my accent, and so that's New York. And then finally I moved out here when Strasberg opened up a studio out here. See, I even have it here now, here.
I heard you're here.
Yep, yep, yep,
yep. You sound like Kennedy.
Yeah, I'm telling you. I can really turn it on if I want, but so I moved out here to L.A. and started doing some television. But I started directing actually in 1988. And in fact, I fell into it. I never knew I wanted to direct, or I never went to college and took any courses that you become a director. And so I sort of fell into it. And so in 1988, I did my first stage directing job. And from there to now, I've done 65-plus shows of stage directing. Yeah, that's a lot of directing. And along the way, I've had a cable talk show, and I've taught acting, and I've coached actors. So I've been very happy and very fortunate in doing what I love to do through these years. So that sort of does it.
That's great. And we're going to be talking a lot more about that. This is a 1-hour show I'm so excited about. But Mo, let's bring the lady to the table. I would like to hear about your background and your professional life, and what brought you to L.A.? So take it away, Mo.
Okay, thanks. I came from so far away that I could be an immigrant. I grew up in rural Arkansas on a really poor farm, and I hated it. I was totally unsuited for it. We lived first in a 3-room sharecropper shack, then we upgraded to a 4-room. I hated milking the cow. It made me throw up. I didn't like getting my hands dirty. And, of course, I had a domineering father, and I didn't like to be dominated. So I did what all poor farm girls do. I got an education and became a college English professor. And I moved. I moved as far west as I could move without falling in the ocean. So that's how I ended up in L.A.
Wow. Both Jim and Tony are on the production side of the South Bay Stories show. But you, my friend, are on the performance side. And we're going to be talking a lot about that, because you have a lot of stories to share. And not that we don't all have stories to share, because we really do. But growing up in a rural lifestyle, we're going to be exploring that. You're also an author, and we're going to be talking about your book to be released in just a couple of months. And I think that this will give our audience a chance. You know, the beauty of an internet show as this is that clearly there are people that are local that are going to be listening to this show and want to know, well, what is this South Bay Stories show all about, and where is it, and how can I get tickets, and I'd like to go because I know I'm personally going. But for those of you that are living in other parts of the country, I don't want you to feel that you're isolated from the conversation, because in reality, this was an idea that was developed by Jim, and why couldn't somebody do this in their hometown? And we're going to talk more about why storytelling is so important. And I've always felt, you know, I've been doing my talk radio show now for nearly 3 years. And I do want to thank everyone that's been following me along that journey. Blog Talk Radio is new to me, and it provides me some alternatives that I didn't have before, which allows me to have people comfortably situated wherever you might be. I'm sitting in my office, in my home, and we can have this lovely conversation. So it's relevant that your storyteller show can be replicated somewhere else. And I just wanted to make that clear so that people understand that this is not just regional. Tony, I'd like to ask you this question, because now that we've gotten to know a little bit about both you and Jim, I'd be curious to know how you met.
Well, it's been a number of years ago. Jim might nail me on the years, I'm not sure. But I had an acting class in the area, and Jim was in the acting class, and we had a nucleus of about 10 to 15 people. And I had the class, and I did it for about 2 years straight. And so for 2 years, Jim and I sort of got to know each other. And so on top of everything else that he does, he's a pretty good actor. So so that's how we met, basically in my acting class. And from there, there were stepping stones on things that we did together and projects that we did together, and including this storytelling. So that's how basically we met. How many years ago, Jim? How long has it been we've been together?
At least 8 years. And, you know, Tony, tell them about your wonderful directing job of The Gin Game, because you and I produced The Gin Game, and you directed it with me as I can't remember the name of the character now, but it was a wonderful experience in the same theater we'll do our storytelling show in.
Tell me about that.
Well, that was one of the highlights. After the 2 years, again, Jim and I had stayed in touch, and I said to Jim, I have a project here, The Gin Game. Would you like to, you know, possibly produce it and be in it? And The Gin Game, those who are not familiar with The Gin Game, it's about two elderly people in a home, and they meet. And all they do during the whole play is that they play gin. And the
gin rummy gin you're talking about.
Gin,
is that right?
Yeah, gin rummy. Right. Gin rummy, right.
As opposed to someone we're drinking. Okay, go ahead.
You're right. And so they play gin rummy. And so the arc of the whole story is that the Jim's character thinks he knows how to play gin and no one can beat him. And in comes this lady, and there's only two people in the cast, and from that part on, they start playing gin on stage. And from that part on till the end, she wins every hand. And so what happens to the character, Jim's character, it changes from being sort of a nice guy, kind of egocentric, kind of I can beat you kind of character, to where the dramatics comes in, where he starts getting hostile towards her, and it gets very dramatic about, because he's getting a little ticked off, that he cannot beat this woman. And so that's the whole genesis of the whole play, and it's quite demanding on the two, because in rehearsal, they not only had to learn their lines. If you remember, Jim, you had to learn how to play gin, because they had to play, okay, three hearts, okay, two spades, and they were going back
That's
and forth.
Right.
No, I don't understand. The cards were going all over the place. So bless their hearts, not only had they learn their lines, they had to learn how to play gin and get the right cards down, on their lines. So that was a wonderful, wonderful experience, and Jim did a wonderful job.
Fortunately, I picked up on my poker skills, and I was able to do a mean shuffle. Remember that, Tony?
right. I said, we're in trouble.
Oh, my God.
I really looked
that's
like
great.
I knew what I was doing.
Yeah.
Well, one thing
yeah,
for sure, Jim, you have a tremendous vocal voice. You speak really well. And I thought while I'm directing this towards you, perhaps you could just share with our listeners the history behind the South Bay Story Show. And why do you think storytelling is so important?
Well, Marcia, I don't believe that we should leave storytelling to the mass media, to the movie industry, to the songwriters, and all that, because everybody has a story to tell. That's my theory.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I have a lot of support for that because there are storytelling shows like the Moth Radio Hour, This American
yep.
Life, that have been quite successful, just bringing in ordinary people who have interesting stories. And one of the things that's really encouraged me is my friends all tell me when I start talking about this that they have stayed in their cars in their driveways to listen to the end of a story on the Moth Radio Hour. So people actually love stories from every point of the compass. And so that was my theory. So I decided, okay, well, let's do it and make it a theater sort of experience for people so that the audience can come and they can hear the story and see the storyteller and be right present with the storyteller, just as people used to do that in the ancient times around the campfire. Because, you know, people have been doing this ever since the human race began, and that's how they entertained themselves. Now, one thing I found out, or I decided, was that music came in to storytelling very early. So I've always had a musical storyteller. And the musical storyteller, you tell your story through music, not words, but music. And so I've tried to have a solo instrument, to tell their musical story in that solo instrument's voice. And I've tried to get instruments that are not, usually heard in a solo performance. For example, we started out with the guitar. And then we had a clarinet for our second show, the last show we had a bass. And this show we will have Chase Jackson, who plays the vibraphone. And those of you who remember Lionel Hampton, you'll know that he's a very popular jazz musician. He played the xylophone. The vibraphone. The vibraphone looks like a xylophone. That's why I said that. And so the vibraphone sort of went out of popularity for a long time, but now it's being revived by a whole generation of new musicians who are playing it in a new way and creating new music on it. So Chase Jackson was one of those new young musicians, and he'll be there as our musical storyteller.
That's exciting.
Speaking
of, you mentioned Chase. I'd like to take the conversation back to Mo now, because you are one of the 10 storytellers. And Mo, does your story have a name?
Yes, it does. It's based on a chapter in my book, but it's called The Miracle. And it's about the day in the late 1940s when we got electricity. We also didn't have running water at that time. And we never did get an indoor toilet, not until long after I left. But the day we got electricity was so exciting, and it changed my life, both for good and bad. It meant that I could read more easily, and that made a difference. And it also showed me something about my father that I did not like.
Do you want – I don't want you to – give away too much of your actual performance conversation, but maybe you could just, I think what I know a little bit about you, prior to your electricity, you were still a very avid reader, correct? So you used a flashlight to read at night?
Yes, I did. If I had to, I used the flashlight and had to hide it because my parents disapproved of my reading so much.
Interesting. How many were living in this home that you had? That was you, your parents?
Five.
Did you have any siblings?
There were five of us.
There were five of us.
An older brother and a younger sister, and we did upgrade. I mean, we went from a 3-room shack to a 4-room shack. And my father built on 2 more rooms. One of them was just kind of a storeroom, but helped. That helped.
Were they farm? Did they farm? Is that how they were sharecropper? How did they support the family?
No. Yes, it was one of my grandfather's sharecropper shacks. They were actually built for black people. But they didn't sharecrop anymore. And my father tried to farm, but he couldn't really make a living at it, so he became a mechanic. He learned that when he was in the Army.
I see. Did you do your elementary school through high school in Arkansas where you were living in your community?
Oh, yes. And I got my BA in Arkansas and my master's. I had to work my way through and got national defense loans. It took me about 10 years to get my
degree. Wow. That took a lot of courage and fortitude to do that, didn't it?
Thank you. I like to think so. And I had a child then also, so it was difficult and slow. At one point, I worked in a factory stamping numbers on stacks of material. But I took shorthand typing, and then I was able to work as a secretary, so that made it a little easier. I wore high heels.
You know, you had a radically different background, it sounds like, from some of your friends. How did that affect your social life?
Well, I faked it a lot. I started in adolescence correcting my grammar. And as soon as I knew I had an accent, I changed it. And then when I came out here, and much later, I got kind of used to being a city girl, and it became kind of an advantage. That's how the man that I live with now, a retired doctor, that's what attracted him to me. He didn't know anybody who had been from Arkansas, so it got his attention. And then you're talking to me.
Yeah. Don't you see how great
that is? I mean, Mo has such a fantastic story. It's like, to me, it's the immigrant story, but it's from right within our country, immigrating from what I would call a third world environment to the first world. And, you know, Mo lives in Manhattan Beach, which is one of the highest class, richest communities in the country. So
you're really
made a long journey.
No,
yes.
Kidding.
I have to do a lot of pretending.
Well, you know, maybe in the beginning, but, you know, isn't there a funny story about you and England? Wait, what was the story where you were saying something, Mo, and people didn't understand what you were saying? What was that story? Do you know what I'm referring to?
You don't mean the Quine of England, do you?
Yes.
when I got out of my place, which was often, or I tried to, he would call me the Queen of England. Who do you think you are? But Mo, you can call me Mo. You don't have to call me the Queen.
Okay. So I'd like to know, why did you leave your rural community?
Oh, I had to. I had to get away. To be myself, just to get an indoor toilet, I had to leave. But I was different from everything that I was brought up to be. And I needed to get somewhere that I felt more comfortable and accepted.
Did your siblings also leave, Mo? Did your siblings go off to college, or were you the only one?
My brother did, but I think he didn't finish. He went as far east as he could go without falling in the ocean. He went to Florida. My sister was handicapped, and she had no choice. Also, my daddy took her out of school when she flunked the eighth grade. So she didn't have a means of getting out. She got to Central Arkansas. She married somebody. So that was as far as she got.
Wow. You know, Jim, this is to you. Your show has had so many amazing stories, like Mo's, that I'm going to hear coming up at the end of this month. How do you find your storytellers?
Well, first of all, I just say I want to hear your story, and I say that to as many people as I can, and they start telling me a story, and if I think it's a good one, or, you know, even if I don't think it's a good one right away, I say, would you like to be on my storytelling show? And some of them say yes. That's basically how it works. But, you know, everybody has a story. And if I just open myself up, pretty soon I have more people who want to tell their stories than I really can have on the show, because an audience can only sit there for so long. But I did want to tell you that, you know, especially the first shows, I've had to encourage people to come to the show. But now I think that people really enjoy it. And so I've tried to make it so that it's a whole evening. It's not just coming to the theater and sitting there for 90 minutes and then going home. For example, I've decided to call the Saturday night show the date night show. It starts at 7:30, so before that, you can go down to the Pier Avenue in Hermosa Beach, which is right down the street from the theater. There are like dozens of wonderful restaurants down there. You can even stroll along the beach, and then at 7:30, come up and see the show, the wonderful date night. And then after the show, you can go home and do whatever you want to do together. And
there
then the Sunday afternoon show that starts at 1:30, I call that the post-brunch show. So if you're so inclined, you can go to church and you go to brunch, or you don't go to church, but you do go to brunch, and then you come to the theater. And after the theater, you can, again, stroll down Hermosa, Pier Avenue at Hermosa Beach. Now, the 4:30 Sunday show, I'm calling the Weekender, because the show starts at 4:30. So you can cap off your weekend by coming to the theater at 4:30. The show will end around 6:15. You then go down Pier Avenue, walk down, have a wonderful Sunday night dinner again at the wonderful restaurants, stroll along the Strand and enjoy the late evening, the sunset, and that would be your whole evening. So it's not only
Sounds
the show
great.
And the story, but it's a wonderful
it's
evening for people.
Sure.
Experience,
sure.
That's right. And, you know, our Hermosa Beach is such a wonderful community
location.
For people to enjoy.
Yeah. It is. Tony, you've done a lot of directing. How is this directing, the storyteller show? These are not professional actors. How does this differ for you than directing an actual play?
It's a big question, and it could take a half hour just to answer it. But
well, you don't have a half an hour.
No, I'm not. So I'm going to. No. Obviously.
No.
I'll give it a shot. No, the difference, obviously, a play is a play with different characters, and they have dialogue, and I direct it as such. You know, they learn their lines, they learn their blocking, or I move them around the stage. And it's a story. It's a story that is a beginning, a middle, and an end that usually pertains to two or three characters, and that's the play. Now, in this particular case, where I'm directing one person, but I'm doing eight different people, that alone is different. Whereas a rehearsal for a play, we might rehearse 3 or 4 hours in one night, the whole, you know, the whole play. In this particular case, we rehearse one person at a time. And so we do different days where we bring them in. Otherwise, if I did all of them, we'd have to be there 8 hours, which we're not. So when we bring them in, basically, we're looking at their performance level and seeing how much work they do need as far as articulating, projecting their words, if they're animated or not. We try to fix, or I try to fix that. So we're not trying to make them actors per se. That's not possible. But we're just trying to explain to them that if they can get through it, that you are not reading, and that's something we'll have to tell you how we're doing. They're not reading the script, but they're telling us a story. And if we can get, and you're telling it to the audience, and as if you were in your living room and you're telling us this story. So we try to use that as the bedrock or the anchor to everybody to get through to them that this is what you do. And if we can get them to a comfortable level to do that, then these stories come alive. And I just tell them, you know, there are certain lines or there are certain words that are maybe need a little punch here or there, or maybe you need to stop and pause a little bit, breathe, let the audience hear that last line, little things like that. So, so it's intimate. I am directing a one-on-one, and but doing it eight different times for eight different eight different stories, and it's quite exciting. It really is.
It sounds like it. Yeah, it's really exciting. And you know because Mo is one of those people you're directing. Mo, you mentioned that you are a college professor. What did you teach?
I taught some literature, and then when I started publishing textbooks, I kind of had to teach what I was writing. So I ended up teaching mostly developmental reading, helping students read better. And, of course, I related to that. So,
well, do you think that because of that, that this experience will help you to perform on stage because you have spoke in front of students and taught? Do you think that that's an advantage?
I hope so. I'm not sure I can achieve what Tony is talking about, but it certainly helped me overcome some shyness and insecurity, the teaching did. But you can take the girl out of Arkansas, but you can't get all the Arkansas out of the girl, so I'm still a little bit shy. I hope my voice will be okay by then because I'm still nasally and snivelly from a cold, but it did help me project.
If I may cut in.
Yeah, go ahead, Tony.
Yeah, I'd like to add something to Maureen as far as directing her or working with her. There are some people that I call natural, that they're just open, that they can come get on the stage and just, you know, be alive, know how to project and all of that. And as soon as I met Mo, I knew that that's what I was getting in her. She's a very animated, very funny lady, and so I knew right away that she had that going for her and that I wouldn't have to work very, very hard getting her animated or just being alive so the audience can connect with her. So Mo is a natural.
Thank you. I hope I won't let you down.
You won't.
And you know,
let me
thing, Tony. Go ahead, Jim.
I was just going to say, on our website, SouthBayStoryShow.com, we have a video, and if people are interested, they can go on there, watch the video, and see Mo, because she has a little part in there, and you can see her and hear her talk, and I think you'll be very charmed.
Well,
and she, by the way,
she
eats fried, she eats fried squirrel too.
I know. Yeah, I was going to talk about that maybe. But, you know, what's so interesting about this, and for the audience to know a little bit of the background, Jim and I have known each other for quite some time now. We've done 3 storyteller shows. We did the lawn bowling show. So I have a connection to you personally, Jim. But I've never met Mo. And I actually met Tony at the last presentation, but he was very, very busy. But in the case of Mo specifically, I've spoke with Mo enough on the phone, and we have communicated back and forth. She's a terrific editor, I might add. Mo, you have so much personality that if you just stand up on that stage and find me in the audience, all right, I'll wave at you, you can just talk because you are that engaging, and I absolutely agree.
Thank you.
That you will be a natural because you're a storyteller. I just think that that's just terrific. Jim, have you ever thought about actually performing in your own show?
Well, yes. In fact, this show, I was going to tell a story. I gave Tony a story about plumbing, and he didn't think that was going to work. So then I showed him a story.
I would have. That would have been impressed just that you had plumbing.
Yeah, that's right.
There's a connection there. Oh, that's funny.
But then I showed him a story that I did about my first kiss, and he liked that one. In fact, I really love that one too. But anyway, we have a lot of good storytellers this time, so I don't think we're going to need me. I try to kind of stay off the show because I don't want it to be the Jim Mueller show. I want it to be the show about all the great storytellers we have and the great stories. And one thing we try to do, Tony and I have worked very hard together to make the atmosphere so that it's very intimate. Our theater
is
very small, and it brings the audience right to the storyteller. And we have the storyteller on a bare stage. We don't try to gussy things up with lights and, all kinds of fancy stuff. It's just the person telling the story directly to the people. And these stories are so good that you can feel, it's almost palpable, the connection between the storytellers and the people in the audience.
I completely agree with you. I'm going to divert the conversation just for a moment because as I watch the clock, I want to make sure that we get to this one other subject before we bring it back to storytellers. And that is, Mo, you are an author. You've done quite a bit of writing, and I was just thinking maybe we could spend just a little bit of time about that. When did you first start writing?
My first memory of writing was in the 3rd grade, and I plagiarized a story I'd read and put it on the teacher's desk, and she read it out loud, and the class was impressed, but this cousin of mine knew that where I got it, so she brought the story up, and she outed me. So I didn't do that again. But,
that was a lesson.
But I found that I had enough material. I didn't need to borrow. So I've published 5 books beginning in 1976. The first one was a historical novel that I was kind of assigned. I got $20,000 advance, and I did it for the money. And the textbooks also. I kind of fell into it, and 2 of them did quite well and went into 5 editions. So that took up a lot of my time, and it was very tedious. But I got started writing my stories probably in the 80s. And I've written over 3,000 pages. So I had to cut it a bit. So my book, Last Trip Home, this last book, this final book, is about 335 pages with pictures.
Wow. And it's called The Last Trip Home, correct?
Right, right. And it's about...
Can you just tell us a little... Yeah, what's it about?
Sure, sure. I've had a long life, so I had to concentrate on this one area that's different from that of most people. So it's about growing up on the farm and escaping the farm, getting an education. I have a clan husband in there whose sheet I burned, and I got the hell out. But what I found is that I had to keep going back, and I thought maybe each trip would be my last trip home. But I was drawn back to help out my mother and my sister, and I still have some of the land, my brother and I do, and I go back and look at it. I have a cousin who leased some of the land and is growing cows. So if I want to, I can go
you
back
grow,
and
wait a minute,
cow
hold
shit.
On. Wait.
Yes.
How do you grow a cow? Did you say grow a cow?
I'm sorry. I leased some land so that he could pasture his cows. I may have said grow, but you can grow them. I mean, you can grow them. They become, they're calves,
okay.
And they grow up.
That's funny.
But in any case, I have relatives back there, and I like to see them. I care about them. And I sure do miss that fried squirrel, especially the brains. They're the brains.
Oh, God,
you
Mo.
Just can't get that here.
Probably
the nearest.
Not. I don't think
you're the nearest.
I thought I saw them at Ralph's the other day for $3 a bushel.
Yes,
you know what, Mo? I got to tell you something.
Yes.
I feed the squirrels that come into my yard. I've named them. I can't imagine Sylvia sitting on your plate. I'm just saying. Okay, but I want
hey,
to ask
Mo,
you. Was it
Mo?
Yes.
Wait a minute, Marcia. Let me ask Mo.
Sure.
How do you cook a fried squirrel? I mean, do you put it in a frying pan, or do you put it on a spit, or you just throw it in the fire?
Oh, you ignorant city boy. You have to skin it and gut, and you have to gut it. Then you cut it up, and you put batter on it, and then you fry it in lard.
Wow.
I'm hungry. Is everybody ready for lunch?
We just lost 20% of our of our listeners right now.
Oh my goodness. You know, it's really funny, Mo, because go ahead.
I was just gonna say you don't want to hear the rest of my animal stories, I'm sure, like my daddy shooting my brother's dog because it was sucking eggs. So Jim wouldn't let me tell that story.
I'm gonna hold back on that one too. What I was going to ask you is, was it hard to write something about that was so close to the bone for you?
Oh,
I mean,
yes. Oh, yes.
Yeah,
it was cathartic. It was cathartic.
Uh-huh.
And but now that it's about to be published and I think about people I know reading it and knowing about my life, it's like naked, walking down the street naked and with all the sags and wrinkles showing. And I'm reliving a lot of it just thinking about people reading it. So I'm hoping I'll get over that.
You know, Marcia, I wanted to say that Mo just mentioned that writing her story is cathartic. And, you know, that's common to a lot of the storytellers on our show. They come to me and they have this story and they're willing to tell it to me. And then I say, oh, but you got to tell it to an audience. And not only that, but you have to create an emotional connection. So you really can't hold anything back. And, you know, at first they're intimidated by that. They don't want to reveal personal things. But if they can finally get over that hump, then they find that the exercise or the act of getting up in front of an audience and telling their personal story and feeling that connection with people, because, you know, people understand and they have the same emotions and experiences in common, just a little different, a little different flavor. And when our storytellers feel that connection and they feel the audience with them, it really is therapeutic. I have heard people say, I'm so glad I told that story. I've had to get that out. It made me feel so much better.
You know, Jim, in saying that, I know because I watched your clip, which was really inspiring. You have a Vietnam veteran speaking as one of your storytellers. Is that correct?
Yes, right.
Yes.
Dave Cook.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, depending upon.
I was going to say, he has a story of comradeship.
Mm-hmm.
And how his comradeship with another Vietnam veteran that he met here in California and palled around with helped him find a path to a good life, to a productive life, because he has PTSD, pretty severe case,
mm-hmm.
and he was going kind of down a bad path. And being with this other buddy and seeing, you know, the effect on the other guy led Dave to a different life that has been very positive for him. So it's a wonderful story of cure, you know, redemption from
mm-hmm.
that awful experience of combat in Vietnam to, you know, a good and decent life with a family and everything that's good in life. So it's
right.
a great story.
Mo, I'm curious, because I know that these stories can't go on forever. Is your story 7 to 10 minutes? How long is your story?
It was 10 and a half, but I've been trying to cut it to 7.
Okay.
And it's hard to
was
do that,
hard?
Because it's hard to be objective about what somebody will be interested in, but I'm doing it.
I would imagine when your stories, and all of the storytellers, when your stories are so rich, I imagine that it is hard to pare it down to that 7-minute mark. Do you find that you're going to be able to memorize it? Are you going to read it?
No, I won't be. I'll have to read most of it. Sorry, Tony. Because I might have Alzheimer's like my mother. I don't think I can remember it all. But I will try to connect with the audience as much as I can.
Yeah.
But I'll have to read most of it.
Go ahead, Tony. You may say something about
that. I want to say, and to Mo too, I wanted to correct her. We don't want our people to memorize their story because then, you know, they're fighting for words sometimes in the head. So that paper in front of them is there for them to read off of, so they stay connected and so they don't have to memorize. So we take that pressure off their shoulders to memorize their words, but they get so familiar with their words because they've had it now for 5 or 6 weeks. It's almost like
mm-hmm.
memorization, so they can come off with the page and sort of say, you know, they know what that line is, but then that script is there in front of them definitely to go back down and pick up the story. So don't worry, Wanda, we don't want you to memorize it.
Okay, but if I can just add something here,
please.
Tony and Jim both shocked me and scared me to death because they told me the last time I saw them that I wouldn't have a podium to hide behind.
Mm-hmm.
So
right.
I have to worry about all kinds of things like sucking my stomach in and things that are likely to distract me. I have to worry more about what I'm going to wear.
The thing, if I may again add on the podium, we realize that, you know, the podium, as speakers know, and I'm sure, Marsha, you know the same thing, it's sort of like a wall between
yep.
the person speaking and the audience. So we take that away so that they are there, bare on stage, to figuratively speaking, and that helps the intimacy for both the audience and the speaker. And so that there is definitely thought out. And when we said no podium, we knew that because, again, it's more intimate rather than having them hide behind a podium. So that's my input on that.
It's all,
I'd like to add something there.
Very cool.
As It is cool. And as an audience member, so somebody on this side of the stage, and like I said, this is going to be my third show.
Mm-hmm.
What you just said, Tony, and I know that it's by design. It's not a mistake. You and Jim, you collaborate to do this. And there is an intimacy. There is a drawing into the story. And you hear the giggling, if that's appropriate during the story. You know that
right.
there will be people in the audience that you actually know. I know that I was fortunate enough to suggest not only your music person with Corbin Jones last time, Jim, but when Jabari was speaking on the stage, he was somebody else that I knew could tell a great story. And I think it's important that people know that there are all ages and genders and ethnicities in these stories. And that's what it's almost like, just sitting in and listening to a snippet of a book you want to know more about, which Wanda's written, which Mo's written. And it is compelling. And you find yourself, when the whole show is over, searching out that one person to say, I want to know more about you. You know, the part
yeah.
when you said such and such and such and such. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
You know, you feel very connected. And, Mo, I would say this as well. While people always have those pieces of paper in front of them as their, let's call it cheat sheet for lack of a better term, I've got them in front of me right now as you and as we are all
okay.
speaking on the radio. I'm prepared with a script to work us through the show when we have, you know, a little over 8 minutes left in the hour. I kind of know the timing. But the important thing is nobody knows your story better than you. The harder part is not telling your story, it's probably condensing it. I would think for me, that would be the most difficult part, is how do I bring it together in a short period of time? And I'm certain that you will. I have no doubt that you will. Did you want to add something?
We definitely.
Either one of you?
I couldn't help but wonder if you had your belly sucked in, Marcia, when you were talking there.
No, you know the cool
yeah,
thing about
see.
Not being visual, you don't even know
yes.
what I am wearing right now.
Yes, I know. You could be butt naked
true.
For all I know.
Well,
yeah, that's the classic question. What are you wearing?
you might,
well, listen.
I want to tell you. Yes.
I was going to tell you, Mo doesn't have to worry about sucking her belly in. She plays tennis about 20 times a
I
week.
Know.
So she's
I know.
She's in pretty good shape.
Yes,
she's in pretty good shape.
I was going to mention that as well. Mo, I just want to make sure that we get this in here before all of a sudden it's like, oh, my God, we're out of time. I wanted to come back to your book just for a moment and – because it's going to be available. So we've talked about how people can find the SouthBayStoriesShow.com online now. That's the www that we all have come to know and love. How do people get to know about your book, and why do you call it a memoir on the front and a hybrid memmy novel on the inside? I don't explain that to me.
Okay, that's one of my worries. That's right up there with feeling like I'm walking down the street naked with my wrinkles showing that it's called a memoir. But back to how you can get my book. It's available for pre-order on Amazon.com now. And I have a blog, which you could learn a little
Why
bit
don't you
more
say the name
me.
Of the blog, Mo?
Oh, golly.
Say the name of your blog.
It's W.M.O. Miller, period, wordpress.com.
Right, it's the WordPress.
But what was,
okay,
I've
cool.
forgotten the other question now.
Well, why did you call, you were talking
oh,
about the memoir.
Yes, right. Well, it started out strictly memoir, total
mm-hmm.
truth that I wrote, hand wrote in journals. And then as I tried to polish it, to publish it, I tried to scenify. It was almost in essay form. So I tried to write scenes, and novelize it a bit to make it more interesting, and also to protect people that are still alive, and maybe to protect myself. But I feel like I didn't. I feel as if I did not protect myself much. But I was going to call it an autobiographical novel. That seemed more honest. But my publisher insisted on memoir. So I at least was able to acknowledge that it's partly fictionalized. I wrote composite characters for some of the people who are still alive. But it's 95% true.
Could you see this being a screenplay at some point?
Oh, maybe. A few people have said that, but I wouldn't write it. I did write Billy Bob Thornton, who grew up in Arkansas. He actually went to the same school as my second husband, and it was a long shot to write him. But I thought, what the hell, why not? And I told him he could write the screenplay. If he liked it, he could play my daddy. But
did he respond to you?
I think that's a no.
That's pretty – he did not. Okay. Well, he might be listening. Who knows?
Perhaps he will.
I'm just curious because I'm keeping an eye on the clock. When you guys – now, I know a little bit about Jim, so I kind of already know this answer. But when you guys are not writing, producing, directing, blah, blah, blah – we'll start with you, Tony. What do you like to do for fun?
That wasn't in the script. That wasn't a question I didn't think you were going to ask.
You're right. Because we've been kind of jumping over the script. We kind of got out of order, so I just thought, screw it. We're moving forward.
Okay, well, my other things that I keep pretty quiet to myself, I like to sketch and draw in watercolor.
Oh.
And another one of my hobbies, I do magic, so one of my things is hoping that maybe soon I can get on stage and do some magic for some people. So I do magic.
Nice.
And basically that's it. Mostly, though, it's the arts, you know. As I said, I just finished a play right now, Arthur Miller's The Price, which just closed a couple of weeks ago. And in the back of my mind, I've thought about going back on stage as an actor once more before I go back to Massachusetts or something. I don't know.
Okay.
So that's what I do.
You know, I know Tony. I mean, I know that Jim is a lawn bowler. I mean, I know that about you, Jim, because that's something that you enjoy. And I'm still keeping my eye on the clock, and I want to provide enough time to talk about next week's show. But briefly, Mo, when you're not writing, you're a tennis player, correct?
Right. As Jim said, I play not 20 times a week, but 3 or 4. But as I get older, I'm struggling to stay average. It's so I don't know how much fun it is anymore. And I walk,
take up lawn bowling. Lawn bowling is cool.
Well,
right, Jim?
Marcia, I'm very orderly. So I spend a lot of time tidying up after my man. He's really messy. So I find myself licking my finger and reaching over and picking up a little gibble that he's dropped. And that's kind of fun.
That's the old dude you're talking about, right?
Yes, the old dude, Dr. Frugal.
You know, I want to just thank all three of you for being part of this inaugural show that I didn't know exactly how this was going to work, but I knew that we could all speak. And I won't always have three guests on my show. So I want to tell my listeners about next week, because next week I'm only going to have one guest, and her name is Christine Conrad. She's a screenwriter, she's a director, she's a producer, and like you, Mo, she's an author. And she's also a friend of mine. We actually met 20 years ago when we worked together at the Westchester YMCA, where I have met a lot of guests that have joined me. And she is a master storyteller, and she will be joining me next week. So as we wrap up this show, I just want you, the three of you, to know that I will see you on Saturday for your March 24th show.
24th.
That I will probably have, pardon me?
Yeah, the 24th. I was just thinking.
Okay,
no,
that's March the 24th. And
the
25th, but I won't be there both nights, both days. I won't be there for all three performances. But as we wind down to last 10 seconds, thank you, everybody. Thank you so much for joining me. Follow us on Facebook. And I look forward to next week's show. Bless all three of you.
Thank you,
Marcia.
And counting. Thank you, you guys. It was a blast.
Thanks, Marcia.
Bye-bye.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
My pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye.